The Tom Woods Show, episode 1875.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Michael Malice is with us today. If you've been listening to The Tom Woods Show for any length of time, you of course know Michael Malice as a very accomplished celebrity ghostwriter and a successful author in his own right. He's the author most recently of The New Right. He stars with me in the animated series, The Politically Incorrect Guide, which you should check out at pigseries.com. P-I-G stands for Politically Incorrect Guide. And he is the host of You're Welcome, his weekly podcast. And I would note that it is not misspelled and you do not need to correct his grammar. And if you do that, you are instantly excommunicated. Now, the topic for today is one that will be a little bit jarring, perhaps, for some people, because I bet there are some people who listen to this program, especially recent listeners, and think of themselves as free marketeers. They want the free market economy, and they want very little government involvement and all that. Well, we're way beyond that here, okay? We typically, now I have friends across the spectrum, and I can talk to all kinds of people. They don't have to be carbon copies of me, but if you want to know my own view, I believe in what's called anarcho-capitalism. I'm really free market. I don't think there's anything the state can do better than the private sector. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. And in particular, we're going to talk about how to explain ideas that seem extreme to most people in ways in which they won't seem quite so extreme. So Michael and I are going to exchange strategies and then just see where the conversation goes. So Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, we're going to hit on a couple things that you and I talked about on the phone yesterday. Let's do them in reverse order from how we talked about them. Because the first one had to do with how do you talk about anarchism in the way we understand it to people in ways that make it not sound crazy. Now, let me preface that by saying that I bet a lot of the new people listening to the show because of COVID are a little bit surprised to hear the A word used, because a lot of us think about, I think, maybe a tradition that we're not all that sympathetic with, or we think of it as chaos and disorder and just random murders or whatever I think people associate with it. But for me, it's just a matter of, I don't think monopolies seem to generate good results for people in any aspect of life. And that was the point Gustave de Molinari made in the 19th century, that we have the market economy and we have competition and it generates great results in every aspect of life, except, we're told, in the most urgently necessary goods. Well, I'm not so sure that we should be casually making that assumption. So that's more or less what we're talking about today. You were recently in a conversation that has not yet been released with Jordan Peterson, and this topic came up. So what are your thoughts on the matter? I have a few.
Well, I want to hear yours first.
Well, first of all, for me, it depends on the context of how I got to know the person I'm talking to. So for example, I got to know an awful lot of people, or let's say a lot of people got to know me, rather, because of this COVID thing. I have been writing a lot about it. I've been doing a lot of podcast episodes about it. I've got a lot of new followers. Just people thirsting for knowledge of what's really going on.
Yeah.
So I think to myself, well, how would I talk to people like this about issues other than COVID? Well, it so happens I wrote an issue in my newsletter this very day on this exact topic. Because I had somebody write to me the other day. I'm going to take a few minutes.
Wait, I got to ask you, how much would it cost for me to read this newsletter?
It's free, as a matter of fact. How about that? I keep that a huge secret.
Wait, if it's free, how would I be in a position to read it? What do I have to do?
Yeah, all you have to do is sign up to get one of my free ebooks. You can just delete the ebook.
Where can I go to sign up?
Well, you could go to chartstheyforgot.com, my analysis of COVID charts. You'll just love it.
Chartstheyforgot.com. Sounds like it deserves a look.
You shut up and let me talk here.
I'm trying to help you.
Where would I be without the help of Michael Malice? By the way, that's a legit question, honestly. In my life, that is actually a legit question. All right, so just today,
I have some legit answers.
Some is the word.
Yeah, it's some not so legit.
I wrote about something somebody wrote to me. A woman wrote to me over the weekend because I had sent out, in one of my newsletters, I happened to mention that I had talked to Saifedean Ammous about Bitcoin. And so it was almost an afterthought, that particular remark. This woman writes to me, and I'm not kidding you, this is the entirety of it. You may have seen me tweet about it. This woman wrote in to me to say, She said, Bitcoin is used by drug dealers. If you think it's a good idea, then I'm not interested in your opinions. That was the entirety of what she said.
Okay.
So I wrote my newsletter today and I said, listen, I deeply appreciate all you good folks who've started to follow me because of the COVID thing. But even more do I appreciate people who came for COVID but stayed for all the rest of the stuff.
Sure.
And realized that the COVID craziness couldn't have occurred in a vacuum. It couldn't have occurred in a normal world. There must be deep and pervasive problems for this kind of thing to have taken root. So the idea that we are the experts, we're in charge, shut up and obey, don't worry about any of the crazy arguments we're making or the nonsense statistics or whatever, just keep your mouth shut. This is the way the state operates in all kinds of areas. It's just not so blatant and in your face all the time. So I like the fact that some people are keeping open minds, like on other questions, not just Bitcoin, but on money in general.
Yeah.
Is the monetary system we live under the optimal system? So it's to say to them, look, it's not just the public health establishment. You know, be willing to consider that it's the whole apparatus. And so that kind of gets them thinking. And then secondly, I use this sort of example. You might, without giving it much thought, be inclined to think that a centrally planned economy would be better and more efficient, more expertly run than one where there's nobody, quote unquote, in charge. You might think that because wouldn't that, at least at first on the surface, seem more plausible that you have somebody planning it out instead of it just being haphazardly planned by a bunch of individuals making seemingly uncoordinated decisions. And yet the result is the opposite. The more you try to plan it, the more anarchic, so-called, are the results. And yet the less you try to plan it, the more orderly are the results. So maybe there's a general principle of some kind at work that we can start to unpack. I begin there.
Okay, that's an interesting approach. It's also different for you and I because I think we have, I don't want to say different audiences, but we attract different types of personalities, right?
Yes.
You're much more of the studious, professorial, dad type. I'm much more of the, you know, Arthur Fleck type maybe. So people are going to be responding to aspects of our personality or our work that are going to lead to different psychological parts of their brain being fired up, which means that they'd be more receptive to certain arguments from me than from you, or I could get away with things that you can't and vice versa. One of the things that I try to do, it's interesting because what they don't appreciate, and it's not their fault, is that like with any kind of ideology, whenever you have an ideology that is kind of radical or, you know, outside the mainstream in any way, the visceral reactions to it are always going to be heavily the same, right? And you can't really blame them. It's just like certain things are just not part of the index card of allowable opinion. So as soon as they try to make their way across that card, preemptively, people have been trained, you know, two or three things to say. And those two or three things aren't really to discredit the ideology. All they're there for is to say, well, we don't discuss this stuff for a reason. So people aren't generally intellectually very uncurious as a rule, but that leaves the ones who are intellectually curious. And what's delightful to me is when people hear me or you or others discuss anarchism, for a certain personality type, and these are the ones I tend to gravitate toward, their first reaction is, well, how would it work? It's not, oh, this is ridiculous. They're actually, to some extent, receptive. And there's two ways this goes, and the differences are subtle, but they're very telling. So the first ones are like, well, how would this work? How would you solve murderers? And that's an extremely legitimate, germane, important question. If you're having any kind of system and people are being murdered all the time, well, we have a problem. That's not a system conducive toward human life and thriving, in my view. But there's also the type that say, well, how would it work? You know, how would you solve for murderers? And then they give their own little speech. And so this is the kind of thing where, you know, they've never thought about this before. They want to perceive themselves as intellectually curious, just like everyone perceives themselves as having a good sense of humor, and everyone perceives themselves as being a good parent, which is not the case for either of those things. So when they respond with a little speech about how what you want is on its face impossible and absurd, at that point, I tend to cut my losses and know this person is not in a mental place to be receptive to what I'm saying and is much more interested in, you know, putting their member on the table and winning in whatever that means, a debate here. So those are the two kind of, so when you're dealing with the people who are intellectually curious, the fact that they're already receptive and the fact that they already understand that there are things that are really not adding up in what they've been told, that to me is like, all right, maybe there's somewhere to go here. Do you do that kind of evaluation when you come across someone else who's skeptical?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, because, you know, I've wasted so much of my time in my life on people who are not going to listen.
Almost 2,000 episodes worth, yeah.
Yeah. That's, oh, that was a good, that hurt, that right here. But honestly, you know, it was something I did recently. I still have Facebook and Twitter on the computer, and obviously I can always get it on a browser.
Sure.
But I took the apps off my phone just the other day because I found that I was getting, because people now, because I'm their COVID guy, they're tagging me and pulling me into arguments that are going to suck my time and distract me from my kids and stuff. And I've already given people the information they need. They don't need me personally. And I understand why they want to do that, but it's a little bit of a laziness on their part. They should be making these determinations. Is this person likely to listen or not? If they're giving me these types of arguments like you just want to kill grandma, then there's no point in having the conversation. Because it's not that no such person could ever, it's not saying that it's metaphysically impossible the person could ever change their mind. It's just so unlikely that that time and effort could be better spent elsewhere. I could be writing something that reaches many, many people rather than, you know, uttering a soliloquy for this one person who's got his fingers in his ears.
And also, if you're the kind of person who goes on social media and you're perception of a contribution is, well, you just want to kill grandma. I don't want to persuade you. I don't want those people on my side because the cost outweighs the benefit, because you're not persuading literally anyone. And all you're doing is being off-putting and coming off as banal. So I think people don't appreciate often that they assume that those of us who make our living running our mouths and talking nonsense, that we want to have, if we want to affect any kind of change or see our ideology, you know, crystallized in reality, they're so convinced that it's a numbers game because you've been brainwashed by government schools, you watch the media, that everything's about getting the majority, which is something I completely think misses the point entirely, that they assume, well, you just want to get as many people, you know, on your side as possible. And that really is not my approach at all. Not only do I think these people are not persuadable, but if you did persuade them, you know, I remember when I was in college and my friend was talking about her roommate. Are you typing?
Because I'm in a hotel.
Yeah.
And because of COVid, they don't have pen and paper anymore.
Oh my
gosh. Because, you know, the virus spreads through pen and paper. So I'm typing something I want to tell you later. I have no other way of doing it.
Take notes, Tom. You're going to learn something here today. I had a friend in college and her roommate was reading Ayn Rand. And I was just cringing because I knew it would be horrible. And the roommate's conclusion after reading Ayn Rand is, no one tells me what to do. And it's just like, I'm like, I did not need to know this. Yeah. Is this the kind of person you want fighting for, you know, I'm not an objectivist.
It's a legit question. Yeah.
Is this the kind of person you want fighting for objectivism? Do you think this is going to be promoting of objectivism, or is this going to be off-putting for Ayn Rand? There's many people who we would agree with pretty much on every issue, but they most certainly do more harm than good in promoting our views. And of course, you and I both know we're speaking specifically of Dave Smith.
I was wondering who that was going to wind up being. Yeah, who else other than Dave Smith? Well, the thing about, okay, let's say the equivalent of do you want to kill grandma would be if I say to somebody, I prefer a private property society,
sure,
and they come back with who would build the roads.
Yeah.
It depends on what their tone is.
Yes.
If it's, well, this is the triumphant response to your argument, then I am not interested in that person because that's like I've been taught to say three things and
yes,
I'm going to say them. And I'm going to assume that the person I'm talking to who appears intelligent has never thought of the most obvious objection. And I'm going to assume that despite all the ingenuity I see around me, laying down long stretches of tar is just an insuperable obstacle. That's a person who's just not creative. Whereas I can understand why somebody might have that. I've
sure
done some episodes on precisely how would you build roads. If somebody says, well, gee, how would you do that out of genuine curiosity? Then we continue. So again,
But you know what else is funny? Can I interrupt you?
Yeah, go ahead.
What's funny in that situation is the leap from government has to build roads to government has to raise your children. That is, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like that's
right.
The issue isn't how would roads be built. Let's assume for the sake of argument, it's not possible in a private society that you have to have some sort of overweening, you know, legal superstructure in order to enforce public eminent domain. And otherwise the highways would be out of control. There'd be no forests left. Fine. Let's get me there. Okay.
Yes.
How are you getting from there to I'm going to take your children at gunpoint and teach them what I think is appropriate. And if you don't like it, I'm going to put you in jail. That to me is a far bigger leap.
Yes.
But that's the leap they're comfortable making. Well, if you've accepted Rhodes, clearly I own your kids. It's
yes.
Like I don't see it.
Well, in part, what I often do is say, look, I'll grant you the roads, okay? How about this? Just for the sake of argument,
yeah.
I'll grant you the roads. Let's talk about a bunch of other things. And if I can persuade people on the other things, then they come back with different eyes
yeah.
when they look at the road question. And they say, oh, you know what? Even though I don't know the answer, obviously we would figure this out. If there's a JCPenney over here and a whole bunch of houses over here, you really think everyone's going to stand there scratching their heads like, oh, I don't know. Why not? There would be an interest in figuring out a way to facilitate this.
And what else is funny, me being a New Yorker, this is information I wasn't privy to, but the big question, and I think this is also a very legitimate question, what happens if I'm some big corporation and I think Tom Woods is a jerk and I buy up all the land surrounding his, you know, whatever, or just in any case, I want to build a road, but like grandma's farm is in the way. And they have things called easeways. I think that's the term. And basically people rent or lease a little strip of land so you could get from the highway to the beach or whatever it is. And there's so many things the market does so well that have already been resolved that by the time you think of it as having an issue, being an issue, they solved it years ago. And the classic example of this that I use is if I'm on Sprint, right, and you're on iPhone, whatever, and I call you, which company is paying which? Is the person who initiates the call? Is it 50-50? Is it, you know, based on what state you're in? I have no idea. I'm confident you probably don't have any idea. But we also know you put the numbers in, and it works.
Yes.
Because both of these companies realized, okay, we want all the Sprint people to be able to call all the iPhone people. Let's figure out how this would work. We'd adjudicate because the cost of you not being able to call someone based on their provider is astronomical in terms of losing, you know, market share and customers, whereas the benefits are very, very high. We both have, so let's figure something out between us. So
right.
That's something that I think is of interest.
They have an interest in figuring this problem out. You and I don't have to. And to this day, we don't even know how they figured it out. But they have a vested interest in figuring it out. And likewise, yeah, your thing about what if I have a house and somebody buys up everything around me so that now I'm trapped in the house. Well, in the same way that things that you might not have anticipated, problems you might not have anticipated, like maybe you don't have legitimate title to your house,
sure.
That's solved by title insurance. Now, you wouldn't have even thought that you need something like that. But again, by the time that occurs to you, that's already been fixed. Well, likewise, it'd be just as easy when you're buying the property to have easement rights built into the agreement when you buy the property. So this is already solved. So again, these are things like for some reason.
Wait, can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
What else is hilarious around this mindset is the idea that if there is an issue, let's stick to my cell phone carrier situation, that the issue would be resolved by every Michael and Tom and Dave sitting around and figuring it out through some kind of group discussion and some meeting over a podcast, as opposed to people who have a vested property interest sitting down and doing it secretly and quietly without anyone else's input because they don't have the technical expertise to add anything of value anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Hey, folks, let's take a quick break for a sponsor message. April means a lot of not-so-fun things. Getting fooled, my least favorite holiday of the year, by the way. Getting rained on, and most years, getting your taxes done. So if you need a positive experience to balance all that out, well, consider doing what Ole Woods here has been urging you to do for a long time, and that is protecting your loved ones by getting life insurance with Policy Genius. This is something you do when you become an adult, and it's time to do it. Policy Genius helps you compare top insurers all in one place, and you can save 50% or more on life insurance by doing so. Once you find your best option, the Policy Genius team sets up your new policy for you, answers any questions you have along the way. All you have to do is head to policygenius.com, and in minutes, you'll be working out how much coverage you need and comparing quotes to find your best price. And the best part, all the benefits of Policy Genius, the comparison tool, the handling of paperwork, the unbiased advice are totally free to use. Policy Genius can promise that you won't leave their website feeling like a fool. You could save 50% or more by comparing life insurance quotes and feel good knowing that if something happens, your loved ones will be taken care of. Go to policygenius.com to get started. Policy Genius, when it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. All right, let's switch over to the second thing we were going to talk about, because in a way...
Can I just say, because something just clicked, and this is something I want to tell like the listeners that would be of use.
Yeah, sure.
If the question is who would build the roads, ask them, have you ever been involved in any aspect of road building in your life? And 99.9% of them will say no. In that case, you do not need to have a position on this issue. Nor are you in a position to offer anything of value. I don't know anything about how hams become canned. I do know that I could go to the supermarket and buy canned hams. And I also know that my input in terms of canning science and in terms of ham production is nil. So I'm bringing nothing to the table, and it is not appropriate for me to have input here.
You know, what's interesting is the two different ways people react when the question is, here's a problem and here's how the government might solve it. Here's how the private sector might solve it. If I describe how the government might solve a problem, people are just more or less, yeah, okay, that's probably how it would work, without pausing to think, but wait a minute, there are a lot of problems with political solutions, and maybe this would instead happen, or that would instead happen. They haven't anticipated any of those, but man, have they anticipated every possible downside of the private sector, because that's where you have all the greedy people, because magically, none of the greedy people made it into the public sector.
I honestly think that their mentality, which they've been trained to believe, which is not completely crazy, is, look, if we're all suffering the problem equally, it's not really a problem.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
It's like if there's a government monopoly and the post office is slow, well, you know, sometimes life requires sacrifices.
Yeah.
And no one's being singled out. So you're just going to have to suck it up
and have that
delivery in a week. Because otherwise, the alternative, God forbid, is you're having a scenario where people don't have mail delivery at all. And that's not tenable. So it's better. The perfect is the enemy. You know the cliches. The perfect is the enemy of the good. So therefore, we all have to sacrifice a little bit. Otherwise, that one or person or that population are going to be totally SOL. And that is just completely a non-starter.
I could imagine, let's say we had a world where there were no battery-operated toys, but we were about to, the technology for that was about to emerge. I could imagine people saying, well, this would be totally chaotic unless the government supervises it, because everybody will have a toy that requires a different kind of battery. So there'll be as many batteries as there are toys and blah, blah, blah. But stop and think, no one would want to live in that world, so therefore we won't. Or every single lamp will require a proprietary kind of light bulb. Nobody would want that world, so I'm not worried that that's going to happen. And yet they do worry about things like this. That every possible free solution, for, you know, freedom-based solution, they've got every anticipated objection in the world, no matter how ludicrous they are.
I remember, you and I are both old enough to remember that when we were kids, sometimes you would buy a toy or have one bought for you, to be more precise, and you come home, you're all excited to play it, and then you saw in small letters on the box, batteries not included, and you're staring at this hunk of metal and plastic and are extremely despondent because you don't have those batteries in your home. And as a result, there was even a movie about this with that title called Batteries Not Included, right? What happened is, as a result, I'm sure batteries became cheaper. Then you had digital batteries, whatever the term is, that you have on your phone and rechargeable batteries. And the problem solved itself through, not solved itself, excuse me, that's me using the exact wrong terms. The problem was solved by the market, because A, people who produce batteries want people buying batteries. B, people who produce toys want people buying their toys. And after time, the cost decreased and now it became a non-issue. But yeah, when we were kids, this was a situation. You know what else is really kind of despicable? I was just thinking about toys. I was just thinking about this the other day, how one of the things I think that people who believe in liberty don't discuss enough is how all of these approaches tend to hurt the poorest the worst. in often counterintuitive ways. And I was in the cereal aisle. And Tom, you and I remember when we were kids, cereal came with toys. You know, this came with this figure, or this came with this game, whatever, so on and so forth in the box. That was made illegal. And I think it was made illegal because under the auspices that like the kids would have too much sway over the parents and this is cheating. I don't even remember the situation. But the consequence of this is the very poorest families now don't have free toys for their children with their cereal. It's really those, because those toys are often crappy. So if you're a kid and that's the toy that you have, you're not doing so hot. But now we're just going to go to, they went to those kids, took it out of their hands. It's like, oh yeah, well, now you're getting nothing.
That happens over and over. And in a way, that's an analogy to how we look at the poor and we say, gee, it's a shame that they are have to buy their, they have to get their furniture from the rent-to-own store. Or it's a shame that they have to have this option or that option. So let's take that option away.
Yeah.
They have a list of crappy options. They picked the least crappy one. Now you've taken that. How does that help them?
Right.
Or this job is terrible, so let's price them out of it. But okay, but if they had a better option, they would have taken it. So the elitists just take away their opportunities and think, well, my work is done for the day. What else can I destroy?
There was an article over the weekend from Cato. I haven't clicked on it, but I'm sure I know what it says, and I'm not being sarcastic, defending sweatshops in other countries.
Yeah.
And a lot of conservatives were flipping out about this. And it's like, do you not understand that in these countries that are destitute, this isn't the Triangle Fire here in New York City. This is really, you know, hand to mouth. They're either in sweatshops or they're in prostitution, or they're basically the prisoners of their often violent husbands. That's what's on the table. I think we are so spoiled in this country, and we're also taught, this is a very leftist mindset, that you never have to make a bad choice.
Right.
That basically you always have, it's like, do you want strawberry ice cream or chocolate ice cream? Like, that's the extent of your choices. Like, you can't lose. Well, in many countries and in many places on earth, you can't win. And you only have horrible choices. And you have to get through that before your society's at a point where it's thriving and so on and so forth. But they do not approach the issue from that context whatsoever.
And it's funny, this is what a conservative is supposed to understand. The conservative looks at the world.
The constrained vision, yeah.
Yes, and as being a place where there is tragedy and where sometimes it's a matter of choosing between something bad and something much worse. And they, of all people, should understand that it's not like, well, we can choose skipping through meadows or whistling a tune. You know, sorry, that's not the choice these families and children are faced with. Our friend, actually, I don't know if you know Ben Powell, but he's at Texas Tech University, and he's written a book for Cambridge University Press on sweatshops. And he actually went to Guatemala and talked to people in what we would consider to be sweatshops. And he asked them things like, well, suppose in exchange for a little bit of your disposable income, you could have the following amenities. So it could be, you know, whatever. I mean, better working conditions or
sure.
time off or this or that. And it was in almost every category, 90%+ of the people said, I'd rather have the money. And eventually, you get, I mean, and by the way, the analogy here is to us as human beings in the United States. When we're younger and we earn very little at our initial job, that, yeah, I just want the money. I don't need massages all day.
Yeah,
I just need the money. But then you get to a point where you have enough money or your salary has increased. And then you say, well, you know what? I could actually use that particular amenity because you can afford it. These people are in a position where they can't afford to indulge the fantasies of intellectuals who think that they should have this, this, and this. They'd rather just have the money. Why not just let them have it?
Tom, I'm sorry, but just that sounds like something out of our cartoon. Can you imagine, like, you know, or something out of Rand? I don't know where this would be, but there's a sweatshop and there's no ventilation. People are shoulder to shoulder. Like, if they make any sound, their knuckles get wrapped by a ruler. You know, they have to listen to propaganda the whole time. And people come in from the West and like, this is unconscionable. And they go, I know how to solve this. And they just give them massages.
Exactly.
So they're still working 18 hours a day, but now their back muscles are a little more comfortable.
And by the way, I didn't choose that at random. I remember years ago, that was a disputed point in a United Auto Workers contract dispute. They wanted massages.
Oh, no.
So I didn't actually make that up.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, okay. You can't instantly introduce massages into every workplace in the third world. It ain't going to go. Now, do you want
to... Wait, who will massage the workers?
That's right. I know, that's a good question.
That's the answer. That's the big question that no anarchist can answer. In your crazy anarchist society, who's going to be giving massages to sweatshops? The market.
Yeah, forget the roads.
Yeah.
Right? This is the issue. Do you want to take a few minutes to talk about the other question that came up in our conversation?
Well,
about
ask it.
How you and I view ourselves in this at this particular moment. Do we think of ourselves as mentors, as something else to, you know, a lot of especially younger people who listen?
Oh, yeah.
You raised that as a possibility. And so maybe we should talk through that.
Yeah. So I, as people might know, last week I recorded an episode of Jordan Peterson's show. It was interesting because I announced that we would be talking in April, and people took that to mean, understandably, that he'd be on my show. But I was actually on his for a couple of hours. He's been on your show, I think twice you had mentioned. It was a very exciting conversation. And one of the things that I admire about him a lot is what a role he's filled in being a mentor to many young men and women to some extent in terms of getting their life together and kind of getting self-esteem and being productive citizens who are creating things of value. In many ways, this is kind of the Randian idea of like productive work being man's highest achievement. And this is something that I've been going down a road a little bit, especially in his absence. I have my locals, malice.locals.com. There's lots of people there. But I also talk to lots of young people because I vividly remember being what it was like for them at their age and you know, being smart and yet feeling isolated. So it's easy for me to give them actionable feedback because I just simply have data they don't. It's not even a function of particularly being intelligent. It's just like I was there. I tried A, B, and C. B works. C doesn't really work. And A is, you know, a disaster. And once they have that data, they can really thrive. But I think you and I have very different relationships with our audiences. And I think my audience probably tend to skew younger than yours. How do you approach this? Do you have these kind of like young men and women that you take under your wing and kind of talk to? Or are you much more of a, you're talking to the more of the business types?
Well, every once in a while, people, well, I get more email than I can possibly deal with, unfortunately. So, you know, there are some ways to reach me that are better than others, but my gosh, I can't really cope with it. But occasionally I see somebody and I say, well, I could do some good for this person. And particularly because I got a PhD in history, I do get people who write to me who want to do the same thing. Now, things are very different now, almost, well, maybe say 25 years later. I'm not sure I would want to repeat this in the current environment, but I do get people asking me for advice on that. And they'll say, well, I want to write a libertarian dissertation. Where would be the best place to go? And I immediately tell them that's the wrong way to think.
Yeah.
You make a genuine contribution to the field. And then when you're out in the world, you can write whatever libertarian bit of awesomeness you want, but it's not the right thing to do. And plus there aren't that many libertarian historians out there. I can probably count them on one hand. So that's not going to work. What you really need to do, given that there are so few jobs in academia for historians right now, so few, is instead of thinking, where can I find a libertarian advisor? No. What's the best university I can get into?
Yeah.
That's the thing. What's the best graduate program I can get into? And then I give them two other pieces of advice. And I say, these things will make you stand out. There are still some hiring committees that do care about standards. That's a fact. There still are. And the two things that they would never have thought of, but that I tell them are, number one, go to the Chronicle of Higher Education website right now, even before you're in your graduate program, and start looking at the kinds of jobs you'd be interested in. And 80% of them are going to say, so let's say you're interested in modern European history. 80% of them are going to say outside field in East Asia preferred, outside field in Latin American history preferred. Look and see what is the most frequently requested outside field. I guarantee you none of your peers have it because none of them looked in advance. They got their PhD, then they went on the market and they said, oh, damn, I don't have that outside field. But you will look in advance and you'll get a few courses under your belt. You're going to be almost the only one, if not the only one, with that. That will, even if they suspect you might be 10% libertarian, they don't want to have to hire a second person to deal with those other classes. You know, so that will help you. Secondly, you could spend all your time on Facebook and Twitter and blogging or whatever. Instead, pour all your spare time into getting an academic article, a scholarly article published in a peer-reviewed journal, because almost no graduate student will do that. If you do that and you have the outside field, you actually have a fighting chance of getting an academic position. But if you don't, it's very, very hard. So that's the kind of advice, they're not going to be able to get that from anybody else. No one's going to think to tell them. So I might as well tell them.
I think that's excellent advice. And it's I also... Let's get a little meta. When giving advice, I always try to either say something original or say something unoriginal in an original way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because that forces thought to be provoked and that forces people to think through the issue on their own terms. So it's amazing how lazy or incompetent most people are when it comes to giving useful advice. And do not ask, I've said this many times, don't, when you're young, don't ask your dopey little friends for advice because they want to sound smart, but they don't have the information. And the odds that they're going to tell you something of value or something you haven't heard before is pretty close to zero.
That's true. That's true. Now, you in particular, at some point, I want to somehow take advantage of your knowledge and presentation style in this. When you spoke at the Mises Institute a couple of years ago,
yeah,
you didn't come in and talk to them about economics or North Korea, which you know an awful lot about. You talk to them instead about things like how to go into a room full of strangers confidently, or how to strike up a conversation, or the kinds of things that they all really needed to know, but they don't know where to go to find that out. They don't know if there is a place they can go to find that out.
Yeah.
They just think, maybe I'm just not programmed the right way. I just can't do these kinds of things. And you, for a solid 45 minutes, gave them actionable advice in that room. And in ways that, okay, maybe you could dig that up somewhere. I don't know where. I think it was both original and the delivery was also original. Honestly, it was one of my favorite public speaking presentations I've ever seen.
And before people ask, no, it's not online. And you're not.
It's not online. You had to be there.
You had to be. Yeah. Literally. You had to.
You literally had to be there.
And I'll give one thing from that talk, which I think will strike a nerve with a lot of people. One thing that drives me absolutely crazy, like really does trigger me, is when people have, and we all have flaws. We all have weaknesses. Maybe you're a procrastinator. Maybe you spend money too loosely. There's a million things it could be. When people have these flaws in their character and they just shrug. Now, it's possible, like Harvey Pekar, who was my mentor, he was really under the thumb of his weaknesses, but he was aware of it. He wasn't pretending otherwise. But if you know that there's certain issues that you have, maybe it's dietary, right? If you're diabetic, or if you're a vegan, or if you keep kosher, you create workarounds knowing, okay, you know, if I am in a place for dinner and they're not going to be serving kosher, or if they're not going to have vegan options, what am I going to do? You know, you anticipate it and you, maybe it's not going to be ideal, but you certainly have your ducks in a row, so to speak, right? So what drives me crazy is when people are like, you know, I'm just really bad with remembering people's names. Well, you know, no one's great at it, number one. And number two is, just because you're bad, you're saying you can't be better. You know what I mean? So it's like, well, I have this issue. I know this is a problem in business. I've tried nothing. And here we are.
I've tried nothing.
No, they literally just shrug their shoulders. They've identified a problem that they have. And they've taken literally zero initiative to improve. And that drives me absolutely crazy. If you have an issue that you understand could help you succeed in whatever aspect of your life, and you just shrug your shoulders and tried nothing, there's something wrong with you on another level besides that one thing.
Well, I think for some people, they think maybe these...
Wait,
this
can I say
over
let
here.
Me just one more thing?
Yeah.
Let me hold your hand all the way to the end. Take 30 seconds and on Google write how to remember people's names and read one article.
Yeah. Yeah, I agreed. Agreed. I think maybe... I don't want to say in defense of these people, but I think the mental block is they see other people who do it with ease and they just think it's something those people must have been born with.
Right.
You know, they that's just the sort of person that they are. But it's true that there are some talents that you're born with, but there are a lot of things that you can acquire through effort.
But it's also this kind of blue-pilled approach of taking things at face value. For example, stand-up comedians, right? A good stand-up comedian, or I would say the vast majority, not even the good ones, the impression you get is that they came to that mic at the front of the room and everything they're saying is spontaneous, But if you thought about it for literally 1 second, everyone would realize, wait a minute, this was a routine. They've worked on it. You know, some jokes land, some jokes don't. They're just performing in a certain way. So yeah, just because that person is good at remembering everyone's names doesn't mean they just walked up to the mic and you know, have this kind of photographic memory. It's very possible that they worked on it.
Yes. And the great ones, of course, make it seem like they didn't.
Correct.
Yeah, but that's what makes them great, is that it seems effortless. It's yes. Like, it's like you doing a good interview on Your Welcome.
That's never happened, though. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
But I mean, I think people think, oh, you just sit there. And
yeah,
you,
yeah.
Look, I've been on the other end of some really rotten interviews
where
the person's got a list of questions on a piece of paper. And no matter what I say, he robotically goes on to the next one. I think I am begging you to get me out of here. I do not want this at all. I want to remind people they should be checking out every month we're releasing a new episode of The Politically Incorrect Guide, which is the animated series starring Michael and me. You can follow it at pigseries.com, pig for Politically Incorrect Guide. And I don't know what the next one coming out is, but so far I'm pretty happy. And how many times have I been in a dress in this series so far? Is it once or twice? I don't know.
Yeah, but much
more to come.
Much less than in real life.
Yes, right. So check that out. And of course, people should listen to and watch You're Welcome, man, with Michael Malice.
Yeah, that ball gown you have for the 2000th episode is just something, I can't even describe it.
People will have to wait to see that. Well, I'll just remind people that you yourself will be part of my 2000th episode event, which I'll have signups for this week.
With the special guest.
With a special guest. I don't know who this is, or for all I know, knowing you, it could be a cardboard cutout of somebody. It might not actually be a human being. I don't know. It could be. I don't know what's going on here.
Okay. Spoiler. It's a rabid dog. And the doors are locked from the outside. Who will shoot the dogs?
Well, I can't wait. It's going to be a ton of fun, as it was last time. Well, thanks a lot, Michael. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
All right, folks, before we wrap up, I have a listener in Australia who has a great YouTube channel, who's been doing great videos. In fact, did a video kind of based on the points I've been making with the COVID charts, where he wanted people to try to pin the mask mandate date on the COVID chart, and you're always wrong. And he's just doing terrific work. But in Australia, it's very frustrating because there are just not that many libertarians there. So it's a very, very lonely work that he's doing out there. He has a YouTube channel that I want you to know about. So normally I help people promote websites, but he in particular said he'd like promotion of his YouTube channel. So his YouTube channel is youtube.com/deactivist. And what you'll find there are some pretty darn good and funny videos making our points in a punchy and pithy kind of way. And you would be helping, he doesn't put it quite this way, but I will, a lonely Australian get the word out. Of course, these are universal ideas that apply well beyond Australia, and he's not typically appealing to an exclusively Australian audience, but he's got that, I don't know, Australian je ne sais quoi, I guess. So check it out, youtube.com/deactivist. I'll put that on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1875. And remember, normally it's a website that I promote. So if you're thinking of starting a website, got to get your hosting through my link. And in exchange, I will promote that website on the Tom Woods Show to make sure you get some visitors. And also, of course, you get membership in my private bloggers group where we help each other out. And I'll send you some tutorials to help you get started. It's all kinds of great free bonuses. Check out the details at tomwoods.com/publicity. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about how to have a society without a welfare state. And we're going to look at an actual case study of how that might be done. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.